Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. When there is a big natural disaster, like the one we're dealing with along the Upper Guadalupe River, the national spotlight shines intensely, but briefly. Once the immediate crisis passes, the headlines move on. It's up to local journalists who remain, bearing witness, documenting the long and difficult path toward recovery. These reporters play a crucial role in ensuring that the needs of the affected communities are not forgotten. They celebrate the wins of recovery while also reminding us of so much that was lost. They work to ensure that once the floodwaters recede or the wildfires are extinguished, the story does not end. Texas Public Radio is committed to covering the long recovery after the July 4th flash flood. And today we're looking for guidance and best practices from reporters who are doing that work right now. We're joined by Erin Stone. She is the climate and environment reporter for the LAist. And Erin, welcome to The Source.
Hi there, David.
Hey, and also we're joined by Laura Hackett, and she is the flood and disaster reporter for Blue Ridge Public Radio. And Laura, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so Erin, let me ask you, so you have been covering the recovery of the LA wildfires. It's been 6 months since that story erupted, and a lot of concern about the recovery, but also a lot of questions about what happened during the wildfires. Can you talk about how you've been covering that?
Yeah, I mean, there's it's a little over 6 months since the actual fires happened, but there's still so many questions about how the destruction got so bad, how folks lost their lives. And in the meantime, there's a lot moving forward. So it's not just me, it's a newsroom-wide effort, keeping track of the latest updates and, in terms of debris removal and, what people are dealing with insurance and temporary housing and stuff like that. But also, kind of the smaller stories about what's giving people hope, who are the people that are becoming like local heroes and helping their community stay strong amidst this? Who are the people that are bringing their neighbors together as they face rebuilding. So we really take a broad look at it. I've done a lot of different stories from those kinds of moments of local heroes to kind of the big picture questions and what do we do next? And I think as we continue to get further and further away, we're narrowing our reporting to be a little more focused on accountability as well as highlighting the hope, because I think people do need to also hear those stories of how people are moving through grief, moving through pain, moving through trauma, while we also need to highlight, the incredible challenges, systemic challenges there are for people to actually recover from these disasters.
And Laura Hackett at Blue Ridge Public Radio, you've been covering the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, which was notable for its catastrophic inland flooding, similar to the story that we're covering in Kerr County area. So this was not a coastal surge, a hurricane story. The storms moved inland. The mountainous regions of North Carolina endured record-breaking rainfall, leading to deadly floods and massive infrastructure collapse. And so this storm was is termed the deadliest and costliest U.S. hurricane since Maria and Katrina. So much damage, so much catastrophe. How have you been covering that?
Yeah, great question. I mean, like Erin said, it's definitely something that our entire newsroom is working on. So, almost a year out from when Helene came inland into Western North Carolina, it still does feel like everything is a Hurricane Helene story. Everything is somehow touched by that storm. Now that we're almost a year out, we are able to have, the dust is settled. We have more data around housing, homelessness. Many emergency response counties have, emergency response departments of counties have published their after action reports, which sort of reveal, what went well, what didn't. And so, and we're really locking into you know, as hurricane season is coming back again this year, how do we keep our community safe? What is the funding that's required? What are the programs that are required? You know, how do we keep people housed? What are the, you know, federal, state, local programs that can help restore our economy? You know, in Asheville, not only was there the initial flooding, but it knocked out a lot of crucial infrastructure. And so in Asheville, the area which feeds water for, you know, the surrounding county, we had a 53-day water crisis because our main water line was in a floodplain and it got knocked out. And so that meant, you know, for 2 months, none of the breweries, none of the restaurants, no business could really, at a time where it's peak tourism season in October in Western North Carolina, nobody was able to turn a profit. And so, you know, it's, I could keep going. You know, I think the stories are sprawling, but infrastructure, accountability, and housing, and as well as those, you know, important cultural stories of resilience, what is the art coming out of, you know, this tough time? All of those are, you know, things that we're keeping the pulse on, you know, almost a year out from Helene.
So, Aaron, I'm reading, and I'm also, Laura, I'm looking at all of your reporting that you've done, and you're on your websites, and a lot of good stories, a lot of good ideas for us to follow up. But I want to ask you about something you're doing, Aaron, at the LAist, where you have a series of stories about should you sue, or, you know, what should you consider before you decide to join a lawsuit? And that's fascinating. And I've never seen that before. Talk about that.
Yeah. So at LAist, we've really focused on coverage that's really useful to survivors. That it's kind of news you can use. We felt that we can play a role as public media in, you know, not having paywalls, you know, having a space to convene these types of conversations and hear directly from survivors. We've done several guides like this, whether it's about how to battle your insurance company and understand all the ins and outs of that, you know, whether or not to join a lawsuit like I recently did. We also recently, you know, a couple days later, the major local utility that potentially its equipment sparked one of the fires here is launching a program to compensate survivors and victims of the fire.
My question is, like, if you decide to take that payout, or is that basically a settlement and you're not able to sue? And are you
right? Well, that's the question. And they announced this program before the details have been hashed out. So we don't actually know the details. So we don't know yet. What my understanding is as of now, I mean, if you're involved in a lawsuit, you can still apply for this compensation program, but they will release the details in later this summer. And, you know, in the past, you know, they've done utilities up in Northern California did a similar program. And there were, you know, concerns about, is this a way to just get out of the lawsuits and, you know, not pay survivors as much? And that those were complaints that arose in past programs. Of course, we don't know the details of this particular program. Only time will tell. But that is a big question, and we'll be following it.
Right, we're taking a break here. Phone lines are open. We want to hear, you know, if you're in that area, if you have a tip, if you have something that you want us to follow up on, give us a call, 833-877-8255. What should we look like for our long-term coverage of the Kerr County flooding? We'll be right back.
Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Hi, this is Ashley Alvarado, President and CEO of Texas Public Radio. Here in South Central Texas, we know the power of community. We show up and stand strong together. That's why we've created TPR's Resiliency Fund, to protect the future of independent journalism, classical music, and meaningful conversations that connect us. And right now, your donation has double the impact. Every dollar you contribute is matched by Texas Cavaliers Charitable Foundation. That match also benefits the incredible work of Camp Camp, a Kerrville nonprofit enriching the lives of people with disabilities. With our resiliency drive, we met the moment. Now, let's build the future. Donate today at tpr.org/resiliency.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In the second half hour, we're going to be talking about new needs and stresses for the local food bank. But right now, We're talking about how to do long-term coverage after a huge natural disaster. You know, we have been covering the Kerr County, Upper Guadalupe River flooding, flash flooding. We got to figure out, you know, how are we going to continue to cover this story? What are the good stories that people need to hear, that we need to tell, we need to document? Public radio is being asked to do more with less. And so we got to get smart about this. So we're tapping into the know-how of two reporters who are doing this work right now. And so, Aaron Stone, let me ask you, you're at the LAist, the LA Public Radio, covering the fires, wildfires that were in January 7th to the 31st of this year, about 6 months ago, destructive wildfires in the LA metro area. I want to play a clip of one of your stories about a 911 call. This is an accountability story, and let's give a listen.
At least 30 people died in January's unprecedented fires, most of them older and many with disabilities. I'm Aaron Stone. I recently obtained 911 calls from two disabled Eaton Fire victims through a public records request. The calls shed light on why and how emergency planning continues to leave people with disabilities behind. The 911 audio is being broadcast with the family's permission. Some listeners may find it disturbing.
And is the backyard on fire or just sparks?
It's just sparks right now, but it's getting close.
All right, we'll give them that information. They should be there as soon as possible.
That's audio from the first time Anthony Mitchell Sr. called 911 at 6:03 a.m. on January 8th. 11 minutes later, he calls again.
I can hear crackling now. I can see the flames.
Okay, and you're in the residence right now?
Yes, we are. Myself and my disabled son, we're both disabled.
Okay, so two people total?
Yes, and it's catching on fire now. I can see the flames.
Mitchell Sr. lived in West Altadena with two of his adult sons. He had a prosthetic leg and used a wheelchair or walker to get around. His son, Justin, had cerebral palsy and was paraplegic.
Hurry, please.
About 15 minutes later, Mitchell Sr. calls his daughter, Hashimé White, in Arkansas, to say he's tried 911 twice. He quickly hangs up, telling her he sees flames. At 6:35 a.m., another family member calls to try to get her father and brother help.
And he said he called twice, and they said they were on their way, but nobody's here.
Yeah, we have a lot of calls in that area. Let me
2 hours later, White found out her father and brother had died.
But I'm absolutely just angry and mad and just upset.
The calls released by the L.A. County Fire Department nearly 5 months after LAist requested them point to inadequate emergency planning, training, and coordination.
Aaron Stone, that's really a moving story, very impactful. What was the reaction to that story?
I mean, people had a lot of folks had, you know, an emotional reaction. People were angry. People expressed that they were grateful to hear the centering of folks with disabilities and older folks in these disasters. A wide array of responses, and also people, you know, grateful that we're still focusing on, you know, what exactly happened that night. So there's still so much to look into, and other local media has done excellent reporting on other aspects of that as well. So, I think hearing people's voices, and that I definitely struggled with that ethically and spoke with the family about it. But I think hearing folks in those moments is important, for us to learn the lessons and move forward and really recognize how horrible it is.
Laura Hackett at Blue Ridge Public Radio, as you've been covering the recovery after Hurricane Helene in North Carolina, a lot of great stories from you. Looking at this is an issue that I think is very important for something we should, you know, look at, the housing question, and you did this story.
When Hurricane Helene hit Western North Carolina, it devastated the region and wrecked the lives of thousands of residents. Months later, some people are still relying on help from FEMA, the state or local nonprofits, while they figure out a path forward. Their stories are the subject of BPR's four-part series, Living in Limbo, a special package of stories exploring housing after Hurricane Helene. BPR's Laura Hackett has this story.
When the floodwaters from the French Broad River swept into Peggy Harrison's home, it shook up her whole life.
Things went everywhere. It was like an explosion. There were onions in the bedroom and shampoo was in the kitchen.
Her home in Henderson County was the place Peggy and her husband Bruce had been lived for the last 20 years, the place their now adult daughters grew up. But she says it's been unlivable since late September when the storm hit. The water ruined some of Peggy's most special possessions. Her wedding dress, old family photos, and a lifetime's collection of Christmas ornaments.
Since my mom passed away, I got a lot of her stuff, and like I got her cedar chest that she had that was her grandma's, and it's destroyed. Just all the stuff that I really cared about is gone and destroyed.
Since the storm, Peggy and her husband go to the house several times a week to sort through moldy items. Most of the stuff gets put in trash bags.
Sometimes I just can't bag it up because it just, I sit there and I cry.
Like many people who were displaced by Helene, Peggy has had to bounce around. First, she stayed at her neighbor's house, and then for months lived in a hotel in Asheville that was paid for by FEMA. The time at the hotel, she says, was nice, but far from relaxing.
It's not as luxurious as I thought it was. I don't know, it's just lonely because I don't know the people here. I only know a few of them, but we all kind of stay to ourselves.
While she grieves her old life and home, Peggy is dealing with tons and tons of paperwork. She says that deciphering how to work through insurance and FEMA policies is complicated.
Well, what I'm learning is always double check. Double check that they're giving you the right information or go behind and follow up.
As of last week, Peggy is out of the hotel. She says FEMA encouraged her to seek other options.
They told me I need to think about other lodging, what I can do on my own, but that's not an easy task.
With a monthly mortgage still due, she says those options have been limited.
I can't pay the mortgage and rent because rent is ridiculous, especially with a dog and a cat.
So, Laura, in your story, you're focusing on one person, but this one person is an avatar for so many people going through that exact struggle.
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking, honestly, to hear that story played back. It just, I think, really illustrates how long of a tail that housing insecurity has from the initial incident. I mean, Peggy, I think, is a good case of she didn't do anything wrong. I mean, she had insurance. She owned a house. She went through FEMA and just how exhausting and challenging it is to move through those channels. It's just shows how, I think it gives empathy for, you know, what other people are going through. I think it's easy maybe if you don't know somebody's story to be like, oh, well, why would they have a house there? Or why don't they just get another house? And it's, you know, it's a very serpentine journey that people are going through after they lose their housing. And these people need a lot of support. And so I think speaking with one person really makes that story hit home.
And I've covered disasters like this at one time. And these people you interview, they stick with you for the rest of your life. You don't forget them. You remember them. And I was covering a flood like this in Denham Springs, Louisiana. And they had one of these freak flood events. It's an inland community, and they got hit hard, and the whole town got flooded. One guy I was interviewing, he talked about how it was a continuing traumatic event because after the flood, then you have to take all of your belongings and drag them out and put them on the curb for everyone else to look at. And you're looking at your neighbor's stuff and they're looking at your moldy, gross stuff. And it's just continues and doesn't go away. That's also, you know, you have to, you're talking about the healing, Aaron Stone, you talked about covering the art, and the art is part of the healing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the emotional aspects of these disasters are just so important to talk about and cover, especially as we see more and more people going through it. And, you know, often it's the worst thing that's ever happened to someone in their life, and it's a lifelong recovery. So, I think local reporters especially are very well positioned to find those stories, to know the folks, to have existing relationships, with people that have long been embedded in their communities. And I think telling those stories of how people are using their art, using their voices, using their community to heal together, is very healing in general, because I think, you know, as local reporters, we're going through it too, right? I myself had to evacuate during January's fires, and it's a community-wide trauma.
Laura, I'm going to play another one of your stories because it illustrates that all the reporting is not always going to be heartbreaking. Let's give a listen to this one about a dog park.
Asheville is known as a dog-friendly city, with everything from dog menus at restaurants to craft dog ale. But in the last 9 months, the city has been missing a key part of canine infrastructure, the local dog parks that were washed away by Hurricane Helene. BPR's Laura Hackett reports on the grand opening of a new park filling the gap.
The new Asheville Dog Park is at a bit of a strange location. It's tucked behind a Walmart parking lot at a small bend along the Swannanoa River. During Hurricane Helene, the area flooded badly, but now it's dried out and covered in mulch, and enough trees survived to offer some shade for park visitors. City of Asheville Parks Director Tyrell McGirt is one of dozens who are at the park's grand opening.
Well, this is a temporary dog park, so we don't have all the things that we would like to have in a traditional dog park, like restroom facilities.
Still, he says he's glad to offer something while the city sorts through rebuilding the other two parks.
So, Laura, covering the dog park, when you're talking about we're still recovering from this disaster that took over 100 lives, you know, it's important to a lot of people, and it's one of these wins that you have to celebrate.
Yeah, exactly. I think after going through, you know, such a huge natural disaster myself, something that I realized is that people grieve the big things, but some of those small details of your life, you know, like whether it's the dog park or the yoga studio or the brewery that you go to, there's grief for losing those places as well. And I think there has been a lot of angst in a place like Asheville. It's a very outdoorsy place. It's, as I mentioned, a very dog-crazed place. And so losing that, you know, social touch point of having that place to go, you know, it's maybe not as serious as a housing crisis, but it means a lot to people. And so to have a place to gather again, it is a win. And I think it's really important to acknowledge those wins, because they matter a lot to people, and we need those wins.
Aaron Stone, what advice do you have for us here at Texas Public Radio? We've covered big stories and long recoveries afterwards, but they've been like Uvalde. We're still covering the Uvalde shooting and other things like that. But you know, this seems different. What do you think we should be looking for?
I mean, I think it's talking to each other like this is really, you know, I've learned so much from your guys' reporting as well. And I think, you know, really just as you said, public radio stations are doing a lot more with a lot less these days, and even more so now with funding cuts. So I think really prioritizing stories has been where we're realizing we really need to go, you know, is really figure out what do we have the resources to cover, and what are the most impactful stories that might take a little more time that we want to identify and really chip away at and dedicate time to, and what are the kind of really community-based just daily stories that we won't be able to cover everything. So what are the stories that are most useful to the folks who are actually going through it, I think is kind of the approach we've taken.
So actionable information, things right. That will help people in their recovery.
Also help them connect to community members, you know, like the story that Laura shared. And I recently did a story on Oral History Project and stuff like that. So I think the stories that help people connect with fellow survivors as well.
Well, Aaron Stone, Laura Hackett, thank you so much for coming on Texas Public Radio today. I am looking at your reporting. I'm taking notes. A lot of good stuff there that I'm going to try to match and covering what we're doing here in our communities. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation. Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.